You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll recap President Trump's UN speech when he denounced North Korea, Iran, and other countries. First, service animals have a unique role. Under the Americans with Disabilities Act, a service animal is one that is trained to perform work or tasks in the aid of a person with disabilities. However, our next guest says there's a growing problem with fake service animals, and the American Kennel Club has even used the word epidemic to describe the issue. To address the problem, a number of states now have laws criminalizing the misrepresentation of a pet as a service animal. Our next guest says that's a good idea, but there's a lot of confusion surrounding what a service dog really is, so there's less protection for their unique status. Wes Seiler is a columnist for Outside Magazine. He wrote the recent piece, Stop Faking Service Dogs. Wes, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, talk about this problem. What are people doing to, I guess, to pretend that their dogs are, in effect, service animals?
Well, it's just a case of misrepresentation. I think there's a big misunderstanding around the law. There's two laws that govern the access for service animals in public places. The first is the Americans with Disabilities Act, like you mentioned, and that covers, you know, restaurants, parks, libraries, you know, what have you. And then there's the Air Carrier Access Act, which only covers airlines. And the Air Carrier Access Act does allow emotional support animals and requires documentation for them. The ADA specifically excludes emotional support animals. So the idea that emotional support animals have access is put out there by the Air Carrier Access Act, but they don't have access to your normal day-to-day public places.
Right, and you're using a couple of phrases that, I mean, if you'd thrown them around before, I wouldn't have known what they meant. So let's define them. First of all, what technically is a service animal under the Americans with Disabilities Act?
A service animal performs a task in aid of a person with a real disability. So if you are diagnosed with PTSD and your dog is trained to calm you down, to do something to calm you down during an anxiety attack, then that is a service animal. If the mere presence of the dog makes you happy or makes you calmer, that is an emotional support animal and that is not a service animal.
So talk about the sort of things that service animals do for people. And you interviewed a couple of people who rely on service animals in your piece.
Totally. And rely is the right word. You know, I have a friend, Kent, and his 12-year-old son, Hayden, has epileptic seizures. The dog is trained to warn him of an oncoming seizure. So if he's somewhere dangerous at the top of a flight of steps or standing up or running, he can, you know, calm himself, sit down, and prepare to go through the seizure. And then while that's ongoing, the dog lays on top of him to protect him and calm him and help sort of mitigate the seizure as much as possible.
Right, and this dog can actually smell a chemical change that is a preview of this coming seizure, right?
Exactly. It smells that in his sweat, which is just one of the incredible things that dogs are capable of. And you can imagine if Hayden's out there in public and his dog is distracted by something yipping at it or barking or attacking it even, you know, and Hayden, you know, goes into seizure mode and he's not warned, he could experience a deadly fall. He fell recently in a Costco, I think it was, with a concrete floor. And receive severe injuries. You know, it's a simple fall, but if you just collapse slowly on the concrete onto your head, it can be really bad. And you know, the split second warning the dog provides is basically life saving.
And in this case, and in a lot of service animal cases, clearly this is not just any dog. This is a dog that's been through some fairly complicated and I would guess expensive training to know how to do this.
Oh yeah, I mean Hayden's family had to raise money from family and friends to put up the $25,000 in cash. There's no finance available for these dogs, to purchase the dog. The dog is insured. If it was ever even down just for a sickness for a few days, those few days would impact Hayden's life. And, you know, these are vital animals. They're incredibly expensive. They are not pets. They are not your average, you know, good dogs. These are highly trained, specific medical devices almost.
We're talking to Wes Seiler from Outside Magazine. He wrote the recent piece, Stop Faking Service Dogs. So that's service dogs, Wes, highly trained dogs that perform a specific task. How about emotional support animals? What is that? Is that defined anywhere?
You know, yeah. Well, one of my readers recently commented that every dog is an emotional support animal. An emotional support animal is defined as one that, you know, helps you feel better, you know, helps you be happier. And, you know, I don't have any diagnosed psychological problems. And, my dogs make me happier. the only official definition is in the Air Carrier Access Act. You have to have a note from a psychologist or a psychiatrist basically saying that, you know, you have a mental problem that your dog's presence helps you with, but that dog is not trained in any way, shape, or form to help with that. It's just its presence helps. It's a pet. An ESA is a pet.
And you write that some psychiatrists are actually writing these notes for a fee online without ever meeting with the patient?
Absolutely. There's a giant scam around this, and there's many organizations that have, you know, highlighted this problem. I read a great article about it in Psychology Today while I was researching this article. You can just go online, spend, I think it was $158 with the website I found, and they'll send you your notes. It's just, the note's incredibly basic. It's just on letterhead from a psychologist. Just says, hey, you know, Wes needs an emotional support animal, let him on the plane. And, you know, you and I could probably fake that on Photoshop.
Now, where we run into trouble, as you write, is when people who just want to have their dog with them at all times and take it wherever they go, stores, restaurants, shops, hikes, even in no dogs allowed areas, they bring their dog along and what? They say, I think this is a service animal. I need this for emotional support. And that gives them carte blanche. In effect, they can take it wherever they want in their view.
Yeah, you know, the ADA is written to benefit disabled people, and it's necessarily kind of vague. It specifies that you can't really ask too many questions about service animals because obviously it would violate the privacy and just sort of the well-being of a disabled person if they had to go around, you know, showing proof or describing, you know, the ins and outs of their disability, you know, multiple times a day. So the only two questions you can ask are, is the animal a service dog? And what task, because, you know, a service animal has to perform a task, what task is it trained to perform? So, you know, you can say, yes, it's a service animal, it detects seizures, right? So only being able to ask those two questions and not being able to ask for any proof, and there is no proof, there is no documentation, the ADA bans that, you know, really opens this up to abuse. You know, you or I could walk into our favorite restaurant and say, hey, Fru Fru here is my service animal, you can't ask me any more questions. And you're right, the business owner can't ask any more questions. So people are really abusing that, you know, a law that's written to benefit disabled people to enable them to bring their pets into places where pets aren't allowed.
Well, I think a lot of people might hear that and say, well, so what? I get Fru Fru with me into the restaurant, no harm done. What is the harm of not service animals being carried into places where non-service animal dogs aren't supposed to be?
Well, there's two big, you know, pieces of harm that are being done here. The first is that, you know, your pet could distract the service animal performing its vital task. You know, if Hayden's walking around Costco with his service animal and your pet Fru-Fru starts, you know, yapping at him and biting him, and, you know, Hayden is going to have a seizure and the dog doesn't alert him and he falls and hurts himself, that's a huge problem. That's not something that we as able-bodied people should be, you know, doing to disabled people and their needs. The second is that, you know, it's already very difficult to be disabled in this country, and it's hard to go out in public. It's intimidating to go out in public, you know, and by making service animals less welcome by having this gross misrepresentation of all kinds of pets as service animals, you know, you could be making life for a 12-year-old boy with epilepsy that much more difficult, which just seems like a terrible thing to do.
Yeah, you wrote about another person you talked to, I believe was legally blind or fully blind, and overheard overheard someone saying and seeing him and his service animal saying, oh, I wish we wouldn't take service animals, in part probably because of all these abuses of the system.
Yeah, and you know that's Randy. He's a mountaineer. He climbs mountains with the aid of his dog. He's an exceptional person, even though he's fully blind. And you know, he was on a flight, and the pet that was on the flight as an emotional support animal spent 8 hours barking at his service animal, and it, you know, pissed off everybody on the plane, and rightfully so. But he felt like people were casting judgment on him as well as part of that, even though he needed his dog to be there because he can't move without his dog.
We're talking to Wes Seiler, columnist for Outside Magazine. We're talking about service animals and people who claim their dogs are service animals but aren't, to get them into places where dogs aren't supposed to be. You can join the conversation now at 800-642-1234. If you rely on a service dog yourself, have you faced any challenges being able to bring your service animals in? Is life more complicated because of these fake service animals? Do you see a growing problem with this? And if you're a dog owner, what do you think about this? Where should you and shouldn't you be able to bring your dog? Do you consider your dog an emotional support animal? Love to hear about that too. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. More coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation now about fake service animals with Wes Seiler, columnist for Outside Magazine. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you rely on a service animal yourself, we'd love to hear from you how that works for you. If you run into trouble with people challenging your right to have that service animal, have you ever claimed your dog was a support animal to get it on a plane or into a place where maybe you shouldn't have? What do you think of this idea of fake service animals? What should change? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Wes, before we go to our callers, you say this isn't all on dog owners. In a country with so many people owning dogs, you're right, we've done a really bad job of accommodating them. Why aren't there dog-friendly stores and restaurants and airlines, for that matter? What do we need to change?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, this is really indicative that there's a market out there for more dog-friendly places. I absolutely get that you don't want to fly with your dog underneath an airplane. I would never put either of my two dogs underneath an airplane. It's dangerous. There's multiple documented deaths. I don't want them out of my sight with strangers being in charge of them. But, you know, lying about a psychological problem in order to fly with your dog just seems like the system is broken there. I think I saw a statistic when I was researching the article that 24,000 emotional support animals fly on JetBlue every year. Why isn't there an airline that allows you to fly with your dog? Why aren't dogs allowed in more restaurants? Why aren't dogs allowed in more bars? Why aren't dogs allowed in more, events? There's clearly a market. There's 90 million pet dogs in America. Why isn't that market being better serviced? And I think it's up to us as dog lovers and owners to work to sort of achieve what we want, which is, you know, more dog-friendly businesses and travel options. But the way to get there isn't to lie about an emotional support animal or lie about a service dog.
We heard from Brad on Facebook who writes, I think a lot of people need them for emotional security, like a security blanket for them to function. That need gets poo-pooed by most people, but that is necessary service nonetheless. Like someone that's fighting a difficult chronic illness or has PTSD, they might need the pet more for emotional support, but isn't that also necessary service, but in a different way? So maybe, Wes, we need to amend or add to the Americans with Disabilities Act language to include people who need dogs for emotional support. Do you think there'd be a case to be made for that?
The question is, where do we stop? Who doesn't need a dog for emotional support? I have tough days at work just like you do. It's really nice to come home with my dog. That's awesome. I love it. My dog is a major factor in my life and making me happy, but that's a pet. And a lot of people have pets. Like I said, there's 90 million pet dogs in America. If all of them all of a sudden are allowed everywhere, then it's just chaos.
And you write about a bill introduced in Congress this summer by Wisconsin's U.S. Senator Tammy Baldwin that addresses emotional support animals. Mm-hmm. What would it do?
So right now, the Air Carrier Access Act wants you to show proof that you have either a service animal or an emotional support animal when you fly. Remember, both are allowed on airlines. But the ADA does not want any proof whatsoever. It doesn't sort of allow proof. So it's actually more difficult for somebody with a true service animal to fly on an airline than it is for somebody with an emotional support animal, which is kind of crazy. So what Tammy's suggesting, which is a little backwards, is that she wants to remove the burden of proof from emotional support animals on airlines as well. So that all you need to do to fly with your pet is to walk up to the counter and be like, yo, this is my emotional support animal. I'm crazy. Let me on. that's a weird bill.
Let's bring on our callers now at 800-642-1234. We have Gail on the line in Wausau. Gail, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to bring up, Gail?
I just wanted to say that I certainly agree with the authors comments and his point. Certainly, anytime someone misuses a system, it really damages those that really need it. And in any case, what bothers me a little bit is that I kind of hear a little bit of dramatism in some of the stories about Hayden, and in no way do I mean to minimize this young man's situation and the importance of that animal. What bothers me a little is that there seems to be a bit of skepticism automatically applied to those individuals that truly do need emotional support animals. And I guess I would just say that the bottom line is truly, you know, that these animals, whether they be for emotional support or whether they be for a medical reason, they must behave in public regardless what purpose they're providing at the moment. And I don't think we should be so quick to assume that if they're for emotional support, that it's kind of an automatic.
I gotcha, Gail. So, Wes, are we downplaying too much the positive role, the necessary role for emotional support animals, Gail is asking?
Yes, it's a great question. Gail, I'm with you there. I really, really believe in the positive impact that animals, specifically dogs, can have on a person's life. With emotional support animals versus service animals. Again, service animals are so highly trained. You know, years of work going into them. They cost $25,000 to $35,000, and all that's just training costs from, you know, super expert trainers. There's no burden of that for emotional support animals. There's no system in place to guarantee that good behavior. Hayden's service animal is trained only to go to the bathroom on command. It'll blow up. It's also very hard to own a service animal to be so responsible. It will blow up before it pees, you know, unless it's given the command. And you just, with emotional support animals, there's no system in place for that training, so it doesn't exist. You know, I train my dogs very well. I'm sure you do. My dog behaves very well in public, as I'm sure yours does. But without a system in place that sort of guarantees their behavior, as there is with service animals, there's just no way to sort of regulate it.
Thanks for that call, Gail. We're talking to Wes Seiler, columnist for Outside Magazine, talking about service dogs, emotional support animals, and people who use those labels, perhaps inaccurately, to get their dogs where they're not supposed to be. We go next to Cindy on the line in Appleton. Cindy, hi.
Hello. Well, I think using a service dog that's not a service dog in this kind of a manner is like parking in a handicap stall without a handicap sticker. It's an abuse of a privilege for somebody who needs it. And I think, you know, like if you park in a handicap stall, you get fined. I think people should be fined if they're abusing this kind of a, you know, service.
Cindy, thanks for the call. Wes, what do you think?
That's exactly right. That's exactly what it is. You know, people need this stuff, and it's our job as we're privileged to be able-bodied. You know, it's our job to take care of people that are less fortunate, and you know, abusing it's just scummy.
Thanks for that call. I wonder about the etiquette here, Wes. If you're a business owner or a bystander or something, and you see somebody you think they're abusing the system, we don't have a lot of wiggle room to work on that, do we? Because especially if you're that business owner, you're worried about getting sued for challenging what could be a legitimate service animal.
Absolutely. You know, and there remains, if you're a business owner and a dog is misbehaving or an owner is misbehaving, you have the right to refuse them service and to ask them to leave. But it's not just, you can't just deny somebody access just for having a service animal or, you know, lying about it. You can't, it's not up to you as a business owner to make a judgment call and say that's not a real service animal. It's very, very difficult for them. Only if the dog is misbehaving can they ask it to leave.
Let's go back to our callers. Anne is calling from California. Anne, hi.
Hi, thank you so much, and I really appreciate your comment. Let me say that I think it is absurd that emotional support animals do not have training, and I myself have never seen one that has been well-behaved. I'm sure there are some, but the fact they are not trained is a major problem, and they should not be allowed to have that tag without some kind of a mandatory certification training to make sure that they actually can behave and be without attacking and barking. And, you know, they're just usually very ill-trained, in my opinion.
And thanks for that call. That reminds me, Wes, you write that there's a process to get an emotional support animal vest or tag, and that is you go online and you order one.
Yeah, it's a service dog vest or tag. You know, whether these businesses are selling them because they really want to help people identify their service animals, or whether they want to, or just cashing in on a market for fake service dogs, you know, I don't know. But it's there's no process for getting a service dog identification because the ADA does not define such a process. You just go to Amazon, type in service dog vest, and order 100 options.
And thanks. We'll go to Elizabeth now in Madison. Elizabeth, hi.
Hi.
What'd you want to bring up, Elizabeth?
I just wanted to make the comment that, you know, when I was growing up, your dog stayed at home when you went to restaurants or when you went places that, you know, there's a place for dogs, and I love dogs too, but what dog wants to even go to a restaurant and sit there with all these smells around them and people that they want to interact with? And I sometimes feel bad for these dogs when their owners want to take them to all these places. I don't.
Elizabeth, I want to jump in because we're almost out of time, but Wes, Elizabeth's saying, hey, this isn't great for the dogs who are being faked as service animals in some cases.
I don't know if that's the case. I mean, you know, I take my dogs to restaurants. They love going to them. I grew up in Europe, which is very dog-friendly, where dogs are regular, you know, fixtures at restaurants. I think more so it's that, you know, you want to make sure the dog is exercised and, you know, has an outlet for its energy before you take it to such a place. You don't want a dog, you know, ask the dog to go to sleep under a table when it hasn't already been running in the park for a couple hours.
So, Wes, a lot of response to this. Do you think that the culture is going to back you on this and say, yeah, let's stop faking these service animals?
I hope it does. You know, all of us dog owners are dog lovers. And if some of us are misbehaving, they're kind of doing it out of the motivation of wanting to spend more time with their dogs, which I totally understand. I wish I could take my dog everywhere. But it's really up to us as a community to come together and try to help other dog lovers, which are people that need them through service animals. And I think that's something that all of us can understand and hopefully can work together to achieve.
Wes, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Wes Seiler, columnist for Outside Magazine. His article on service dogs is linked over at the Ideas Network Facebook page. You can share your thoughts while you're there. Coming up, we'll look at President Trump's UN speech with a former U.S. diplomat. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. In one of his most important speeches for the international community yet, President Trump had some strong words for North Korea and its leader, Kim Jong-un.
The United States has great strength and patience, but if it is forced to defend itself or its allies, we will have no choice but to totally destroy North Korea. Rocket Man is on a suicide mission for himself and for his regime.
The president spoke this morning before the United Nations General Assembly for the first time. The president's warning follows growing hostility between the U.S. and Pyongyang as North Korea continues to develop nuclear weapons and missiles to deliver them. President Trump also repeated his campaign promise to scrap the Iran nuclear deal.
The Iran deal was one of the worst and most one-sided transactions the United States has ever entered into. Frankly, that deal is an embarrassment to the United States, and I don't think you've heard the last of it, believe me.
Cecile Shea joins us now. She's a former U.S. diplomat and now a senior fellow with the Chicago Council on Global Affairs. Cecile, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks. Nice to be on air today.
Before we get into specifics of North Korea, Iran, and elsewhere, big picture, what did you make of this this opportunity, this address by the president before this big global audience?
I thought it was really a missed opportunity. The president's, particularly the president's first ever after being elected address to the UN General Assembly, is really his chance to tell the rest of the world that the U.S. still wants to be a leader, that the U.S. intends to use its immense wealth and military apparatus for good and for peace in the world. And instead, a lot of this speech came off as a campaign rally type address. Particularly the early part of the speech where he was talking about how high the U.S. stock market is and how his administration has cut back on so much federal regulation. That's not really of interest to someone who's tuned in from Mauritania or from Laos. They all were listening for the big picture of what the president tends to do during his term to secure and provide prosperity and peace for the world. And so on that level, I think the speech, sadly, was a miss. I think he could have really done a lot more to speak to the global audience rather than to the U.S. audience.
I've seen some observers point to a theme that might have gotten overshadowed by the totally destroy North Korea comment. The president kept referring to strong sovereign nations being the key building blocks to human peace and prosperity. And really, that word sovereignty being a key, individual nations seeing to their own interests first. What did you make of that?
Well, you know, it's interesting because up until this point, he has not really said much about what his overarching philosophy of international relations are. So that was the most spelled out philosophy that he has stated so far. And interestingly, it's similar to what President Obama's philosophy was. And President Obama, in his first speech at the UN General Assembly in 2009, had a similar message, but said, frankly, a bit more elegantly, where he noted that he, like all leaders, was responsible first and foremost to his own citizens and to his own countries, and that was the basis of how the world was organized. But then President Obama went on and defined that in a much broader way, noting that when other countries prosper and do well, that is good for Americans. So I wasn't too surprised that there was an underlying message, since President Trump has said that his underlying message is America first. What was disappointing was the lack of sophistication in how he presented it. He seems to look at politics, at international relations, as a zero-sum game. For the U.S. to lose, other people have to do worse. And nothing could be further from the truth. When other countries prosper and are more secure and are more stable when their people are healthier, the U.S. economy grows much more quickly. The U.S. is less likely to need to use military force. The U.S. is better able to predict the future. So on that level, I think that his centeredness on sovereignty was a concern, in that he defined sovereignty and what is good for the, he didn't define sovereignty too narrowly, but he definitely defined what is good for the American people quite narrowly.
And on issues like trade, that's something obviously he talked a lot about in the campaign, that idea of a zero-sum game was front and center. And I think that came up again today, the idea that the United States has lost out in multilateral trade agreements. What did you make of what he had to say about international trade in this speech?
Well, that's really an excellent example of how his definition of American sovereignty was different from President Obama's. President Obama believed that the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which is a very large trade arrangement that would have involved 10 to 12 countries. President Trump has now pulled us out of the Trans-Pacific Partnership. But President Obama believed that that agreement was good for America, that it would make America more secure, and that it would make America exceptionally more prosperous. And at the same time, it would also improve working conditions in other countries, and it would make other countries more prosperous at the same time. So he defined belonging to that type of a large trade agreement as being very good for the U.S. and not in any way taking away from America's sovereignty. President Trump, I think because he was playing to certain parts of his base during his campaign, people who are opposed to trade agreements, because it's true that on the micro level in some communities they can cause harm. He made a promise to pull out of the TPP. He has pulled out of it, and he continues to say that he believes that that is in the best interest of the U.S. But the fact is that his entire cabinet believes the opposite. The people around him all know that pulling out of the Trans-Pacific Partnership is actually making the U.S. less wealthy and in the long term potentially less secure.
Talking to Cecile Shea from the Chicago Council on Global Affairs, looking at President Trump's address to the United Nations General Assembly earlier today. Cecile, let's get to North Korea now. The comment from the president that we heard, we've been hearing through the day, really, that if it came to a military response to North Korea, the United States would have to, quoting, totally destroy North Korea. We expected, of course, a message addressing the North Korea concerns and nuclear program and missiles there, but totally destroy North Korea has definitely gotten a lot of attention.
It has, and it's partially because of the way that he said it and where he said it. You know, the U.S. policy throughout President Obama's administration and previous administrations was, if the North Koreans should attack another country, that we would destroy North Korea. So that is nothing new. We have always had that as a deterrent. We have always warned North Korea that should they attack another country, we would destroy them. But we have said it quietly. We have said it without emotion. And we have not made it into a campaign issue. And the North Koreans have noticed. I mean, obviously, we have a problem right now. But it seems that the kind of bellicose rhetoric that is coming from the White House is actually exacerbating the problem. Previously, there would perhaps be one missile test or two missile tests a year. The number seems to have increased. The North Koreans answer this kind of rhetoric with more strength from their side. I think the other problem that President Trump perhaps needs to realize is that while we are clearly dealing with some sort of sociopath, a sick person, and I give President Trump a lot of credit for noting that the people who have suffered the most under Kim Jong-un have been his own people, with famine and with just horrendous human rights abuses in the country. So I was glad that he mentioned that. But the problem is that while Kim Jong-un may be crazy, he is not completely irrational. And so we need to ask ourselves, why is he continuing on this nuclear program and on the missile program? And the reason is because he believes that that is his safety valve, that is his deterrent, keeping the United States and South Korea from invading North Korea. The nuclear program, combined with the massive amount of artillery that is aimed at Seoul, is, from the North Korean perspective, the reason that the U.S. and South Korea has not invaded the North. Now, we may think that is just not true, that the U.S. would not invade North Korea without cause, but that is how they look at it. So when the U.S. threatens to invade North Korea, and President Trump's remarks today will be seen that way, it just is going to cause the leadership in North Korea to want to expedite their nuclear program, because to them that's an insurance policy. That's a deterrent to the U.S. taking action.
We're talking about President Trump's UN speech with Cecile Shea, former U.S. diplomat, now a fellow at the Chicago Council on Global Affairs. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What did you think of the president's speech at the United Nations today? What's your reaction to his threat to destroy North Korea if they threaten the U.S. or its allies? What kind of message do you think the president is sending to the international community, for better or for worse? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're continuing our conversation about President Trump's UN speech with Cecile Shea, former U.S. diplomat, now a fellow at the Chicago Council on Global Affairs. You can join in with your thoughts and questions at 800-642-1234. What did you think of the president's speech, his remarks about North Korea, the Iran nuclear deal? What do you think about the role of the United Nations? Should the U.S. Work more with the United Nations on global hotspots, or go it alone more than it currently does? Call in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Cecile wanted to talk about China a little bit. President Trump talked some about UN resolutions regarding North Korea, but also worried about countries that were still trading with North Korea, maybe supplying technology to North Korea that might be relevant to its weapons programs. Was there a message to China here?
I think in part, I'm glad that he also thanked China and Russia for voting with the U.S. on some recent resolutions. I think that was helpful. You know, the underlying problem with China is somewhat similar in a strange way to the problem that we have with the North Koreans. The Chinese are not happy with the North Korean regime. They certainly agree that it destabilizes the region, makes the world less safe. But what they absolutely positively worry about is that should the North Korean regime fall, that the U.S. and South Korea would move into North Korea, there would be a unified Korea that would be very friendly to the U.S. and very negative toward China. And so what we need to figure out a way to do is to have very quiet, I would say, secret talks with the Chinese, saying if things go bad in North Korea, this is what we will do. We will give you authority over X and Y. We would like to do Z, and do some pre-planning to lower the anxiety among the Chinese. President Trump's speech today is going to cause a lot of angst in Beijing, because they are going to think that the U.S. is preparing to invade North Korea and to set up shop on a very long border that it occurs between North Korea and China. And so the U.S. needs to find a way right away, first of all, to lower anxiety on that score, but more importantly, to find a way to cooperate in a detailed plan for what exactly we are hoping will occur in North Korea. Are we looking for regime change? Are we looking for a soft landing? Are we looking for this regime to stay in power but to simply stop forward momentum on its nuclear and its missile programs, and how can we work with the Chinese on those things? And if we can lower some anxiety there, maybe then China will agree to cut off some more of the trade and other assistance that they are giving to North Korea.
Let's bring on a caller now. Mike is with us in La Crosse. Mike, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to make the comment that, you know, I voted for Bill Clinton, you know, a long time ago, and this diplomacy thing just doesn't work. They keep advancing their nuclear programs. At what point do we say that we have a good leader in there that's the right man for the job right now? You know, China doesn't seem to want to help. You know, at some point, you know, when do we say enough's enough? I mean,
Mike, thanks for the call. I get your point. We've been negotiating with North Korea a long time. That hasn't prevented the development of this nuclear program, Cecile.
Yeah, I feel the same way. I mean, I was working on CATO, the Korean Energy Development Organization, back in the 90s, and it was frustrating then. This is a very frustrating problem. You know, one of the frustrations, I'm sure, of President Trump is he works in a business where you can fix things. You know, if the engineer comes to you when you're building a high-rise and says you can't put the bathrooms there, the plumbing won't work, you move the bathrooms, you rejigger it, you make it work. Sometimes in foreign policy, there are just no good solutions, and this is one of them. All we can keep doing is trying to slow him down and work with him and try to prevent what at this point sadly looks to be somewhat inevitable, which is that he is going to find a way to miniaturize nuclear weapons. Now, why do I say sadly inevitable? Because there is no good military option. If we try to take any type of military action against North Korea, the immediate counterattack will involve destroying Seoul, which in turn will mean destroying the 11th largest economy in the world, which will have enormous economic repercussions. I mean, first and foremost, it will be a humanitarian loss of just unimaginable proportions, probably the biggest humanitarian crisis since World War II. But there would also be a huge economic price to pay. And so that's the problem with seeking a military option. And so we keep looking for ways to talk to them, ways to bribe them. Frankly, that's what a lot of our programs are ways to bribe the North Koreans to stop their program or to slow down their program or to let in inspectors and hope that we somehow find a way forward on this that prevents a nuclear war. That was the reason for President Obama's clear statement that should North Korea ever use these weapons, that we would destroy North Korea immediately. That was a powerful deterrent. But I totally agree with the caller. This is a really frustrating situation. And it's the frustrating part is there is simply no good trustworthy way out of this mess that we're in. There are only some choices that are less dangerous than others.
Briefly, as we wrap up, Cecile, what is the next step you'd like to see taken when it comes to North Korea?
I mean, I really think that the Trump administration needs to enter into very quiet talks with China about what is our view of the future. What are the United States' intentions? What can we promise China that we will or will not do to make them feel secure enough about their border that we are going to respect the integrity of their border with Korea so that they will do more to help put pressure on this regime?
We'll leave it there for now. Cecile, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you very much. Thanks.
We've been talking to Cecile Shea. She's a former U.S. diplomat and now a senior fellow with the Chicago Council on Global Affairs. She joined us today to talk about President Trump's speech today in front of the United Nations General Assembly, talking about North Korea, sovereignty, and more. Still time to share your thoughts over at the Ideas Network Facebook page.